The next poem, Youthful Experiences of a Different Kind, a Different Culture. People are familiar with the bar mitzvah, Jewish ritual, rite of passage. You may not know that there's kind of a competition for having a good party to celebrate, and that figures in this poem a bit, as does the funeral, also a rite. This is called Twice Lost to Pity. People's hearts go out to you at a funeral. It was my misfortune to want their love. I moved for the second time through their midst, their dark suits and dresses, their faces filled with compassion. My first father died when I was 7, and 7 years later, my second father was gone. He had taken me to temple to become a man one warm autumn Saturday, singing words memorized without meaning, surrounded by men, surrounded later by women, later still by girls at my own cheap party. My older brother had an elegant party in a downtown hotel. Stiff-legged, he danced my mother around the room while our father, in his last munificence, began without solace his dying. My party was at the Knights of Columbus, a Catholic order, and to save money, no adults or relatives attended. The chicken was cold in the middle, but the band played all rock, and for a little while I twitched about in a suit custom made at Mr. Tony's, the tailor my father frequented. And either I had grown or he had taken me to the world he was king of, short on talent, fond of shark skin and pinstripe, an ability to conceal. The pants were short and the jacket too tapered, but it was one of a kind, a single button, slit pockets, narrow lapels, and in the slight breeze foreboding winter, the slim wafer of a November sun. The suit shone blue or green from a faint plaid no two girls could see at once. We buried a stranger in a wooden sleep. In temple on Friday nights, I liked when we sang the mourner's Kaddish, my brother standing by my side. He often looked away when faces familiar with our family greeted us with affection, but I wanted each indelicate woman to carry me to her bed. I came to know myself as this boy without fathers, twice lost to pity, to the moment I remember my mother longing for someone's touch, and I asked if it was wrong to laugh with friends who had come to help me forget. Her mouth was lovely, warmed by the whiskey, and for once the bitter turn in her smile was missing. Anything was possible. To be loved, to be loved, to be loved. Thank you. Thank you again. The next poem, I want to acknowledge Delmar, that wonderful local magazine, for publishing. And after it appeared, hundreds of people asked me what was wrong with my marriage. So I fell back on that remark that poets make. It's a poem, I wrote it, and I hold to that. It's called How Undignified a Man. He sipped his coffee and tried to pull out of himself a caring thought. All he heard was the wake of last night's event. In a crowded room, he had picked one appealing woman to watch and imagined she, as she studied the room after returning with a non-alcoholic beer, had seen him and wondered whether to let him know. They were both married, or if she was not, she carried either an accidental child or was in love and would never need to marry the father. Her body, thicker than it must have been a month ago, radiated her comfort at being pretty, expecting nothing, and yet her eyes were still uncertain, or maybe a movement of her mouth stirred his thought that she, like him, was unhappy. Deep in his own marriage, he had become easy with despair, had gotten familiar with feeling alone, and thought it would last forever, had seen the pleasures of the flesh belong to those with expectations, those Friday nights when the outdoor cafes filled early along the avenues that led to the park. Their own passion, short-lived like the flame when a piece of paper towel catches accidentally the corner of the burner, flared, and then the comfort, the long-held embrace, left a slightly acrid odor in their room, a hint of ennui, and for him and for her, without saying so, the disappointment. At times they agreed. Pornography was the married's best escape into lust for the body they no longer craved. Then they lingered, open to each other's unhurting need. When he thought about what had left their marriage like a flock of ghosts leaving behind their bodies, or if that wasn't at all what it was like to abandon the chance to drop everything, say on some Tuesday in summer, leave work and meet at her flat to be the only thing that mattered, long kisses, the slow rise of a hand to touch what had already been given, to be abandoned by this instead of to this killed him. So when he thought, as he worked at home, how little his love felt like love, he felt sorry for himself. He thinks about how undignified a man looks when he has an affair, how the words it must take to build it, except with the oldest and closest of friends, sound like insults to three people. I know this is foolish, but I can't help it. I'm not happy. You are so beautiful. And he knows these words will work, even though they say that he can hurt people and will. Okay, you better cut that out now, or you're going to be doing it all night. It's like a precedent thing. This next poem is called Vichy. I think I think I have my facts straight when I say that Vichy was the French government that collaborated with the Nazi occupation of France. I'm interested in that kind of collaboration as a metaphor in this poem, that sense of going along with something even as you resist it, and the confusion that ensues from that. Vichy. I call that plant Vichy because it is a great plant, but it is in part a collaborator. Look how it spears the air, long variegated fronds of agave reaching toward the sky. It keeps to itself all that has ever rumbled in its roots. I like it, and once in a while turn it one full rotation sunward, drenching its darker side, revealing it to be small, dwarfed where no one is looking. Who left this plant to me is now long since gone. I suspect she lives with her boyfriend. Can we be boyfriends at our age? Because she doesn't return calls. And when she does call, it is only because loneliness has descended on hidden wings and dive-bombed her day. I get drawn in, am asked the sorts of questions to which only the wrong answer is right, such as, do you miss me? I'm sorry. Lost my place. Such as, do you miss me? And the follow-up to it, I mean, really miss me. Then someone says yes, whom I feel is not me. Later I can tell the truth, but for now it is best to comply. And all that really matters is to stanch the sadness, to know that even though I am captive, I must protect my captor. I might begin to believe I have no stake in what arrested me, and wish only its demise. I subtly turn the conversation back toward the one she has gone to, gone over, as if to the other side. And she seems to brighten, as today, in the chill house and the emptiness, I turn Vichy toward the light. Thank you. I'm going to read two more. I think it was inevitable that my neighbors would inspire me to try to talk about their lives and however imperfectly. Neighbors whose lives are old and troubled and whose way of living out each day struck me, maybe by contrast to my own. This is called Sweet. The Christmas lights still in the window wait, and the shoes that don't fit and need to go back wait, and the messages to be returned wait, as if one more day were needed, and then everything in its own sweet time would be okay. Let the dog bark and let the cat back in. Leave the burned out bulbs in the fixtures, though there's danger in the shadow cast where a blaze should light your doors. Let the neighbor worry when the storm comes, that her son's ventilator will fail, and with a rush his lungs settle, and no one can call out. Let the queen of talk radio pose the questions to sports trivia fans while she holds the phone away from the feedback. She can see kids come down the alley with sticks and turn the dumpster into a drum, and she can fear that the window will break, even while she gets old and far away from the source of her memories, which themselves grow nearer and nearer. Each day she descends the dark steps to the mail, and sometimes with a cake in one hand and cane in the other, she brings baked goods as an offering. For someone has brought her gooey butter cakes and rolls with twists of white icing, and a chocolate sea whipped with a frenzy yet still now, glazed over beneath a cellophane pane. She cares nothing for the sale date, passed now by the days that never stop. She doesn't want them to, because the pale winter sun sails higher and there's no baseball as yet. Her porch chair is turned over in the frozen grass, her rose bush bandaged, bare and brown. No one redeems us, but those who ask, who let the days pass, wait for something that will not occur unless it be the sudden, inevitable storm and blackout. Seems utterly faithless, but I want it to be the opposite, so I don't know what went wrong. The last poem is called Back Rub. And with a light heart, I dedicate it to everyone who winces when someone says, "Would you rub my back?" Back rub. I've just come from a place where the shadows are inappropriate for the middle of the day. My stepfather's bedroom has its shades pulled, air conditioner on, and king-sized bed made except for his portion, where he has climbed in naked after undressing in silence, unseen, laying his barreled chest and massive arms against the chilled sheets, his slender legs trailing down, almost invisible, like a fold in a curtain. Soon he will begin to snore, dreaming as a shark dreams, moving through dark water, swimming to stay alive. He will sweeten the air around him with breath that smells of bananas. But before he falls asleep, he will call out one of our names. Today, mine. Tomorrow, my brother's. I go, because he is a shark and there's no escape. When I reach his room atop the stairs, I enter softly and close the door, the air cold as a path through snow, and go around his bulk and lie beside him, hoping he is asleep. Then I ask, "Daddy, where does it hurt?" And he tells me to rub his back all around, shoulders and thick neck, lower where the shrapnel entered before I knew him and before he knew us, lodged where the spine curves like a tail between his legs. I make circles on his back with my fist, folding the flesh like a tailor's cloth. He tells me, use both hands, and I work harder till he calls out for punches and chops, and I am pounding away at him because he doesn't budge or talk, and still he will not snore. He lies there like a god I no longer believe in. Beyond the shades, a day is wasting. When I try once more to rise, he stirs, and I know it is too soon to leave, that I must go on running my fist up and down his spine in a futile effort to heal him. Finally, his snores begin, growing louder, a sign that soon they will break on shore, and he will turn and go deeper, heading out to the colder waters in his dream. And I think of a day when I will be released, though it means he is dying. His snores catch like cloth torn in mourning as I speak to be free. Thank you very much.